Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays. You're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like? Because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora. He's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/Count the Dings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Tom, are you team pizza or team parm?
Ooh, I could live without eggplant parm or chicken parm. Shout out to Khaleesi's and Fortuna's back home, the delis in which I would get the chicken parm and eggplant parm. I can't live without pizza, though. I'm going team pizza.
I'm spiritually team pizza, but I'm a gay man in Los Angeles. And if I can get the carb-free, protein-based version of pizza, I'm doing it. This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, who would have thunk it? It's the Frank Lloyd Wright episode of Top Chef you did not know you needed, but you did. There is, for the second time in 4 weeks, Tom, no quick fire challenge. Is quick fire challenge getting the short? What happened to quick fire challenge? It's more of a novelty than a staple now. Really interesting episode for a lot of reasons. And I also thought it was, in my opinion, an episode where Kristen Kish really comes into her own as host.
I love this episode, and I didn't realize how much I missed the conflict. This show hasn't had much conflict this season, and we saw with Kalina and Alicia a lot of conflict. We'll get into that later. And I think you need that tension. I think you need that discomfort, and we had a little comfort and discomfort on this episode. The chefs did not have their best game, and we had Buddha and Kristen at the end give a little bit of a pep talk, and I think that was representative of largely a miss for the entirety of the group, with the exception of Rossica and Danny. But I really loved this episode for not only Kristen, and she wore her emotions on her sleeve more than I expected. When she choked up on Pack Your Knives and Go, I gasped in my apartment. I was freaking out. I did not see that coming. And usually we get that at the end of this season, but here we are with Kristen in episode 4, getting emotional during a double elimination send-off. And Kevin, it feels like this was maybe the strongest episode of the season for me, because it just had a little bit of everything. And we don't love team challenges, but I really loved this episode.
Yeah, it was a really interesting episode. I mean, first of all, it was one of these cerebral challenges. And they do this every once in a while where, you know, they really want the chefs to create a narrative based around the dishes beyond just, hey, tell me about something you made when you were growing up or something that pays homage to your grandmother or something like that, but actually kind of delve into the interdisciplinary area that is architecture and say, hey, do something that speaks to one of the 20th century's great architects. It's really funny. I mean, this is how just a ridiculously awesome Frank Lloyd Wright is. I almost intuitively say, oh, he's a mid-century architect, because you look at the properties, you look at the structures, and you think, oh, well, that's something that would have, you know, proliferated right after the war. Yeah. Like, no, that guy was doing this stuff 50 years before anybody else, right? Wisconsin, he grew up in Madison. I think that's where he went to high school. And if you go all around Wisconsin, there's a ton of Frank Lloyd Wright stuff. It was very fun when I was there for Top Chef. The Frederick Boak House, which is literally like two blocks from the Whole Foods they go to in this show, was put on the market for like $1.7 million. And of course, Milwaukee being Milwaukee, and anyone who's been exposed to ridiculous coastal real estate prices in the last few years, you go to Milwaukee and it's like, you can live like a king here for nothing, you know? And it was on the market and it's gorgeous. And you can drive right up to it. And so that was very cool. I'm with you with Kristen Kish. Like, you don't want to see the chefs underperform, but there is the closest thing this show will ever get to like Brad Pitt as Billy Bean going into the locker room and just taking a friggin' baseball bat to, you know, the boom box and saying, this is what losing sounds like. You know, the show gets close. Tom's done that a couple of times over the course of the show where, you know, they've hit a slump and it's kind of the second week in a row the chefs aren't really cooking up to their capabilities. And maybe those are the challenges. Maybe it's the field. It might just be chance. But yeah, you don't get that a lot. And you know, Kristen, the emotions you spoke of, I agree, Tom. I was moved the same way. It clearly pained her to sort of really have to castigate a chef that she stood in those shoes, and she knows how hard it is to fail as a chef, and to send someone home for bad cooking, you know, is hard. And you know, at the same time, you also got glimpses of her throughout the show as a judge. She can be devastatingly tough as an earnest judge. Like Tom, she has so much honor for the food and she worships at the altar of balance, and you feel the weight of her disappointment when these dishes aren't good. Like, you're starting to really sense that. She's different than Padma. You know, Padma would get icy, but like Kristen's go to the fundamental flaws in the dish, and she's cutting without being sarcastic. You know, she's not Tom. She doesn't have that fastball, but you can see her disappointment, right?
Yeah, and there's a certain substance to what she says and a certain credibility to what she says. And you're not sitting there when Padma says it, there's not like any skepticism to what she's saying, or like, does she really know what she's talking about? Of course she does. But when Kristen says it, it feels so much weight behind it.
Yes.
And
yes,
that's where it feels like it really, you feel it in a way that in past seasons, early seasons, Padma, maybe she was easing into her, you know, critiques and becoming that strong voice. Whereas Kristen's coming out here, and you get the sense that she's a little disappointed. Like, guys, what are you doing? You know, come on, bring it. Bring it. Like, seriously, bring it. Stop playing soft. Come out here. And that speech at the end where she was like, you need to last long enough so that you can tell your story. And it was almost like a threat to them. Like, if you don't pick it up right now, we're going to send your ass home before you can really make an imprint on this season. And I love that. And look, Frank Lloyd Wright, as soon as it came on, Kevin, I immediately thought of your house. And I was like, right angles, Kevin is going to love this episode. And I don't know if you expected a Frank Lloyd Wright episode. I didn't. So when they brought it onto you, you must have been like, hell yeah, this is going to be awesome TV.
Yeah, it was great because, you know, Taliesin is right there. It's kind of, I think, in the hills. And it's like funny because you always associate like Wisconsin and the upper plains as being very flat. And this gorgeous kind of hilly area to the west of Madison. And that's where Taliesin is. And of course, Taliesin West is out in Phoenix and Scottsdale, which is kind of his western annex starting toward the end of his life. I think like, what was it, like the 30s, 40s? I think he died in the 50s. But yeah, it's a great, I mean, all these, obviously he was a Chicago architect through and through once he kind of grew up, but Wisconsin's where, you know, was his home. And it were so many of those structures sit, including like, again, the Frederick Boak House, which sold, I think, right as the Top Chef was ending. But it was fun. And so they had to do the tour. And, you know, that included, you know, going to Monona Terrace, which actually is kind of hilarious because if we have Madisonites listening or Wisconsinites, It is this conference center. It is this convention center that sits right on Lake Monona. But what they didn't tell you is it's ridiculously controversial in that way that everything in a university city is controversial. Like, it took 50 years to build this thing, and there were people who were against it because Frank Lloyd Wright was toxic, or they displaced all these kind of more lower income fishermen who would kind of stand at that spot and fish in the lake, and they would feed their families on the fish. Like, it was one of those things in a very kind of the hot box that is Madison, Wisconsin politics. And like, for 50 years, they argued about building this thing. Like, the dude died in the early 50s and they built it like in the 90s. Like, that's how long it took to revive this thing. It went through like protests. And so it was very funny to watch the lovely rep from Wisconsin or whoever was representing the convention center saying, yes, we look out here and there's nature, and you look this way and there's an urban landscape, and all that's true and it's beautiful. But like, if you ever talk to anyone from, if you talk to two people from Madison, they will give you like five opinions about Monona Terrace. Like, it is either a white elephant, either it's like a triumph of the city, like getting its act together, whatever it is. But like, it's such a contentious structure. So it was very funny to kind of watch them just sort of like, oh, and here's this convention center that he inspired. It's not really his plan because they changed it so many times, but it was very much like he was in the center of it. And the fact that a lot of people thought Frank Lloyd Wright was a terrible person, despite being a brilliant architect, was also very much a part of that delay.
The duality of man.
Yes.
He's
yes.
a brilliant architect and a total asshole.
Exactly.
Or whatever you want. We have a perfect episode for that, Kevin, because they had to do that duality for these dishes, and they had to duel in sort of picking and pairing up in the schoolyard. And you know, I get so jacked up for this.
Tom loves a schoolyard pickoff. He does.
And Kevin, this one packed a lot of action, because when you have 12 chefs, okay, and they're standing out there in the field, from left to right, we're looking at a photo of them standing here in the schoolyard. It's Manny, it's Kaylon, it's Rossica. I think in the back there, that's going to be Amanda there, next to Savannah, then Charlie, Danny, Alicia, Kalina, Michelle, Dan, and Laura. Okay. Notice how Dan is looking off to his side. He's looking towards the middle of the group. Laura on the end is like, oh, I guess he doesn't want to pick me for the partner, because usually what happens in these things, Kevin, you just go to the person next to you, because that cuts away from the awkwardness of like, I actually want to get over on Manny's side, but Manny's all the way on the other side, and if I walk over to Manny, it'll be awkward, and I don't want to like piss off anyone in here. This seems like interpersonal warfare, that I'm going to like walk to the other side of the schoolyard to go pick my person. If I walk over there and I don't get that pick, then I'm the asshole, because then I don't want to be next to the person here. And there's all this internal monologues going on here. And what ends up happening is, more often than not, you just kind of pick the person next to you and go, eh, you want in? Okay. So we do get that with Manny and Kevin. They're kind of the round bros who are standing next to each other. And there's Rossica kind of looking at Kevin, who's like, I'm going to go with Manny. Then you have Rossica and Danny. So Danny and Rossica aren't next to each other, but they are runners. They are French Laundry. They get each other.
The early morning running club, I think, is like a very real thing. Like, you and I have been running. Like
yep.
you get a running partner, like that becomes a core part of you know, a core friendship in your life. So
yeah.
It's clear they kind of are simpatico.
And they obviously hit it off right off the bat, but they are not standing next to each other, okay? Who is standing next to each other? We got Alicia and Kalina. What a train wreck that whole yep. partnership was. But they were standing next to each other. There's the Michelle goes with Charlie. Michelle's got immunity on this episode. So if you're standing next to Michelle, do you want to go with Michelle? Do you not want to go with Michelle? And so our guy Dan's looking into the inside and he's looking for his partner, and he ends up selecting Amanda for Team Demanda or whatever they called it. And that was kind of an interesting one, because it seemed like they're very far apart, and Laura ends up with Savannah. I really like that dynamic. But Kevin, we had a little curveball here. Michelle gets immunity. We know that. But so does Charlie. Charlie teams up with Michelle and gets immunity, and everyone is like, F that. F that. Because they're like, what did he get for immunity?
Yeah.
He just got lucky.
Yeah.
And they said as much.
What's going to be interesting is look, immunity is now becoming a fixed part of the elimination win. So anytime there's a pick'em, does this mean like everyone is going to bum rush the immunity person? Like because that's the question. Here's how I would have liked to seen it played out. You don't give Charlie immunity if they are the losing team. And what I like about not getting him immunity is now you put a lot of onus on Michelle to carry him, right? Like if she screws up, she knows she doesn't pay, but her partner. So I like that dynamic. And I think if you get to a situation where, hey, you're scheduled to eliminate two chefs, you got to eliminate two chefs. Hey, you can only eliminate one chef because they're the losing team. Let's say Charlie and Michelle were the losing team. Mm-hmm. It would be only Charlie. And then what you do is you look to the next worst team and then you have a cook-off.
Yes.
Between those two chefs to see who takes the other side. See, I don't know what, because you deprive yourself of a bunch of cool dynamics that might have existed. Furthermore, I don't know what you're going to do in the future, because now everyone, every time there is one of these schoolyard situations, they're going to just bum rush the immunity contestant. Like, I don't know what you do there.
I like your design here. So it would be Charlie goes, he gets eliminated, but then there's a cook-off to see from the losing teams, or I guess the middle teams in this case, to see who joins him in Last Chance Kitchen. See, that would be better. The whole Michelle and Charlie dynamic, and we'll get to it. I didn't really, it just seemed low stakes. Low stakes. Yeah. I'll just put it like Charlie and Michelle knew, whatever, they're going to be fine. They've got immunity. And Charlie, this isn't like Rossica getting looped into a free immunity. This is Charlie who's been struggling to assert himself in this show. So he freeloads with Michelle. And we find out that the partnerships are the Team Chicago, Alicia and Kalina. We got the Runners Club, Rossica and Danny, feels right, they said. The technical chefs, the ones who were trained at the French Laundry together. We had Manny and Kevin, the Power Bottom crew.
Yes, the Power Bottoms.
Yeah, which has a lot of different connotations here. And then we have Amanda and Dan, who call themselves Demanda, which is fun. They're like a little a rock group or a tag team, WrestleMania, Demanda. You have Michelle and Charlie who are already cleared, and Savannah and Lara. So Kevin, I posit to you, what is your power rankings of duos right off the bat?
I mean, I think Danny and Rossica, and I don't say that with any hindsight, because I think one of the true things about this challenge from the very outset, it was clear, is this was going to be a very technical challenge, right? Judges wanted to see architectural features. They wanted to see plates that showed form, that featured shapeliness and complex textures.
Surprise. Yep.
You know, all that stuff was going to be rewarded. And I think Danny and Rossica are just very, I mean, particularly, I mean, Danny is already carving out his identity as a very technically astute chef, right? I mean, I think Rossica is a five-tool player. She can go any which way. She can go homely. She can go technical. She's got clear head skills. You know, Kevin showed well for the first time with technique, something he struggled with. So I think all right off the bat, you got to look at Danny and Rossica as saying, hey, these are technical chefs for a very technical challenge.
I totally agree. They're the number one team on my board there. I would go Manny and Kevin next.
That's what I had second.
I probably go Alicia and Kalina in third, and they totally blew it. The Team Chicago, I'm just saying before we got to see them, and the whole like, I always hated Gemini. Actually, I'm a Gemini. And then whoopsies. And then that whole interaction. Even before then, I'm just such a fan of Kalina. And she was very high on my draft pick. And I felt like I probably had them maybe behind Amanda and Dan. And then, you know, Michelle and Charlie too. What I'm trying to say here is Rossica and Danny were far and away, I think, tier one. In terms of the pick here. And I would say after that, it's kind of Manny and Kevin. And then after that, you know, we'll see. But the point is, I really thought that we were going to get a curveball in the editing because it seemed like Rossica and Danny were just smooth sailing all the way through. And Kalina and Alicia were not bad vibes the entire time. Just absolute terrible vibes. And I kept waiting for them to make that switch, for things to click, and for it to turn around. And Kevin, it never showed up. It was from start to finish, they were trailing.
Yeah, when you start having semantical arguments about whether it's water or sea, Like, I think you're kind of getting it. There's already kind of a fundamental tension underlying the entire operation, right? I mean, I'm surprised you have them ranked this high. I haven't seen a lot from Alicia, this chef, and I don't like to kick a chef when they're down. I mean, you know, her ricotta gnocchi, and I think was the first, was her first kind of elimination thing, and it was fine, right? It was fine. It was a little unbalanced and whatever, and then she got into elimination and had, you know, the smoked salmon roulette. It was fine. It was a snack, you know, and then last week she had a perfectly fine fried ball, was I think what Gail Simmons called it. So, you know, I hadn't seen a ton of her, but it was a problem. And I don't think it was conceptually a problem. I think Agua Chile is actually a really smart way to go. But boy, that was a really devastating critique from Tom Colicchio when he called it what a first year culinary student trying to pretend to do a fancy dish. I mean, God, by the way, he is salty. Tom, God. He is salty. He is really salty this year.
Just cut her down. And man, that hurt. And you know what? I got to say, when I saw that dish, it did feel like that. Like, it did look like that. It didn't look very strong.
I kind of felt for her, Tom, because like I thought that was really clever to do the cucumber in an oyster brine. Like, I felt like it was a little unfair as a critique. That's a real thing. She didn't stick cucumbers on a plate. She brined them in this like oyster brine. Like, yeah, I mean, look, obviously the food was substandard, but I really felt for her in that situation.
Yeah. And we kind of buried the lead here, Kevin. Buddha is here. And what an episode for Buddha to be there for is something that I think he would have excelled at this episode. I felt he would have just hit a home run on this. And so, should we tell the people what's about to happen?
Yeah, I think let's promote some very cool stuff coming down the pike, starting with this.
Buddha Lowe is going to join us on Pack Your Knives this week. As part of our premium episode, we are going to have Buddha Lowe on the show. He's going to make his triumphant return after winning back-to-back Top Chefs, World All-Stars. We're going to get his take on this episode and just kind of catch up with him after World All-Stars and where his life is with the twins and see how things are going. It was great to see him on this episode. And that's not all that we're going to be bringing to Pack Your Knives this season. What else we got on the pike?
We're going to be hosting, you and I, a live chat during Top Chef next Wednesday. So that's Wednesday, April 17th. So if you're listening to this episode as a recap, that's the next episode. It'll be at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific when the show airs. And you can participate in the Substack app or just on your desktop. It's totally free. The only thing we need from you is you do have to sign up. So you have to subscribe. Yeah. You could be a free subscriber if you want. We encourage you to be a paid subscriber, but you can be a free subscriber and sign up and be a part of it. You will get an email before the chat starts. And we're just going to be like doing our thing during the live show. And it should be really, really fun. And it's a new feature in our new Substack. It is a maiden voyage for us. We hope to do this on a once in a while basis. But again, go to packyourknives.com. And just sign up. And that's all you have to do. Once you're signed up as a subscriber, you have free admission into the chat.
Yeah. And spoiler alert, we'll make sure that you know that as a subscriber, if you want to wait for the show, there's going to be a way for you not to see the answers if you would not like to participate. But you should come participate. It'll be a party. We're going to have everyone there. You can chime in. Kevin and I are going to be there, but there might be a special guest. We don't know. We're going to try to work on having a special guest appear in addition to yours truly being there for the live chat. So PackYourKnives.com, a Substack live chat, and also PackYourKnives.com if you want to listen to Buddha's appearance on the show. We've got Buddha Lowe on this episode of Top Chef, and he is there with Dominique Krenn, who I am not totally familiar with her work, but I can tell you one thing. They are very familiar with her work, and they were really, really excited to see both of them. But I was surprised at how much they were jazzed to see Dominique.
Producer Anthony Mays, San Francisco native. She is a San Francisco heavyweight. Atelier Krenn, I think I'm pronouncing that right, is in Cal Hollow. I've never eaten there, but it is regarded as just sort of, I think it's kind of how many Michelin stars it is hoarded now in the last decade, but a bunch. She opened kind of a, I think a, a a bar, Bar Kren, which is attached, which is just like looks like one of the most gorgeous spaces. She does a lot of kind of Japanese accents with French cooking. It's just like the best food, apparently. It's been on my list for ages. I've not gotten there yet. I don't have occasion to be in San Francisco as much as I used to, but I've got to get there. And you can tell just the sheer reverence that all the chefs had. I mean, there's that moment when they announce it where you can tell, you know, there's a difference between that of, you know, the obligatory, oh, isn't this nice? They're joining us. And they're like, you know, the true kind of celebrity starstruckness of a group of chefs. And you could tell the level of deference they have for her. She's super cool.
Yes.
And by the way, apparently married to Maria Bella, the actress. So I did not know this.
Oh, well, we've got lots of Hollywood interactions with this this season so far. I mean, I was already excited for this episode. And then we get Buddha and Dominique Kren. So we've got a really good setup for the elimination challenge. So let's get into it. We've got a little bit of disagreements on the themes that they want to go with. So we get similar and different, which is kind, in my opinion, a little bit of a cop out with Rosca and Danny. I get what they were going for, but similar and different is kind of it's structured, but it's not narrative based. And it was so perfect for them because they didn't have to go with some sort of story or anything like that. They knew exactly what they were doing. It was a Buddha surprise. Like, you could see everything on that plate. It was just Buddha.
Buddha bait.
Yes, Buddha bait. And hook, line, and sinker, it was a hit. Whereas the others tried to do story and narrative. I don't think it landed. The chicken and the egg, it sounded good in theory, but the chicken... They had the egg on there, didn't really make much sense. And then they didn't have much egg at all. And so the narrative can really trap you. So I'm curious, Kevin, what are your thoughts on doing something as like a blank canvas, like similar but different, and then going with something with a little bit more story attached to it?
All right, this is just my speculative analysis. Like, I think Danny and Rosca decided, hey, rather than narrative, let's just worry about concept, right? Because that's an interesting concept, which is similar but different. In fact, there's sort of a fascinating, and it was very Buddha-esque. Remember, he did that great charcuterie platter where it looked like wine, but it was actually this. And it looked like, you know, pate, but it was actually that. Mm-hmm. And so they both have this same exact, that little egg, you know, the quenelle. But Rosica's was made out of dal. And it looked identical to Danny's, which was actually a scallop mousse.
Crazy.
And so, but they had that, but it was a very architectural shape, right? Like, it was very, you saw those cool molds they were working on. I just want to, like, honestly, Tom, I just want to shadow those two in the kitchen for a night. Like, that would be time well spent. So they both had totally different dishes, but they had that one constant, right? Which was that quenelle, that eggy, that oval thing that looked like a little ball, you know? And then Danny does his, hey, I'm going to do zucchini and green chartreuse. I've never had chartreuse. I've seen it, like, and I've read about it, but like, it's like a layered vegetable cake, kind of a paste. Like, I don't quite understand it, but, and it was very mild, which I think Tom's comment, but also very good. Whereas Rosica then goes to, with her egg, she has this pickled, right? Like pickled beet, carrot puree, and a rasam. Consomme. So rasam is a South Indian soup. It's generally, I think it's two major components are tomato and tamarind. So when you heard Kristen talk about the acid that works so well in the dish, that's what she's talking about. I mean, tomato and tamarind, right? And she just nailed it. Like, Rosica is on fire. Tom, I was looking at your score sheet. Holy cow. I mean, she is jumping out to she has the potential right now, Tom, to like become one of the high scorers, to get into that
upper echelon,
to that Hall of Fame area.
She's getting in the pantheon.
You tell me.
She's in the pantheon already in terms of like first quarter of the show. She's in the pantheon track. And by the way, awesome personality too. So she just is such a bundle of joy on the show. And she's very humble, it seems, when she's, it seems genuine that she's surprised when she wins. And she just, there's this warmth about her. And so sometimes there's kind of these cold killers that you feel like they're just there as like an assassin, but not really feel like you want to hang out with them on a Friday night. I feel like I would just have a great time with Rosica. And she just seems just on another level here. So Danny and Rosica, if I could trade for Rosica, it would probably take my entire team to get her right now. That's how good she is and performing on a level. And I got to tell you, Kevin, I know what they were doing with the, hey, Rosica and Danny come on out, and also Alicia and Kalina come out. There was so much drama there because you knew who was walking the plank. When Danny and Rosica are going out there, and then you and your partner are going out there, you know you're getting guillotined. And it was crazy television because they tried to make it, oh, I can't believe you guys got eliminated. When everyone in that stew room knew, like, as soon as Danny and Rosica went up, that they, whatever the other two were, they were going home. And you could see it on Kalina's face. And I think that added to Kristen's emotions when she delivered the verdict, where they knew as soon as they walked out there, they were going home. And look, there was a lot of mushroom in this episode. Like, every dish seemed to have a little mushroom element, and I love mushrooms, so I was very excited about it. Agua Chile, we've already talked about that. They were, quote unquote, very disappointed with that one. But the cheesecake was cardboard, and they were banging it on, not cardboard, it was brick. They were banging it on the table at one point to emphasize how hard as rock it was. And I just felt like, This is like vintage Top Chef, where it's not like mean, but you're feeling how just disgusted they were with this dish, with this the two dishes. They were upset about it, and you could feel it literally while they're banging.
You could literally hear it, Tom, like the audio at the table, whatever the boom mic was above the table, like as they tried to cut into that thing.
I can't remember on the show. We just had World All-Stars. I can't remember a time where it was just this in your face at their dissatisfaction.
And it's a shame because I really like the idea, right? Like, I love like an earthy mushroom goat cheese cheesecake. Nori Tuil actually looks great. Candied mushrooms to kind of give it some sweetness to the earthiness. Like, conceptually, I really like the dish. It's a real shame. But you're right, Tom. Like, one of the things the show has just never even pretended to do is kind of play with protocol. Right. It's kind of been known for the last decade or so that, hey, they're going to come back there. The first people they're going to call are the top, and you're going to go there. And now everyone else has to stew and wait. And that's got to be torturous. And then they come back, like, they don't play. It's not like a chorus line. Remember, like, the very last scene where he's like, everybody, these names, step back. And then at the very end, it's like, those of you on the back row, you're in it. Like they don't play around with that. They don't try to screw with anybody's head anymore. I think in the early seasons, they would try to kind of, ooh, you don't know what's going to happen. Who are they calling them because they're on top, or are they calling them because they're on bottom? Like, everybody knows, right? And so that was really unusual. We hadn't seen this particular MO in a while, where it was like, and it was very interesting. I do feel like, as a viewer, I love the deliberations. Like, I love when Tom and Gail and Kristen.
We didn't get that. Yeah, you're right. We didn't get that.
Really get into it when they really kind of do the in-depth analysis of each dish, right? Like, I do feel like I missed that a little bit. And I imagine that, hey, they did decide to devote more time to sort of the journey and going to these various sites and learning about this architect. And some of the conferring and in the case of Kalina and Alicia, some of the tension in the team. So that's just not where they devoted the time. I did miss it a little bit, but apparently it was just so patently obvious that there was one great team.
Yes.
There was one awful team. And frankly, they seemed underwhelmed with the other four as well. And we can go through. I would like to run through them quickly.
Yeah, let's run through them. I didn't mean to go all the way to the elimination, but the, you know, it just was.
No. Those are the bookends. I mean, this is very much this show. You're right, Tom. Like, this show, this episode was very much about the top and the bottom. They did not. This wasn't about the middle, right?
The middle, I scored it. Manny missed. We'll go into each dish, but I felt like Charlie was a meh. Michelle, they didn't like the biscuit.
No.
Didn't work. She knew it. Dan and Amanda, I had just meh. Like, I don't think either of them really starred there. Kevon had a big bounce back. Good to see that. Yeah. Laura, I think they liked her phyllo pastry pistachio with the raspberry release, a little bit too sweet, but I felt like they enjoyed that one. In Savannah, it was a meh too. It was fine. So I really didn't feel like any of these were even close to Danny and Rosica. Like, it was uneven for all of these groups, and it was uniformly bad for Alicia and Kalina, and uniformly great for Rosica and Danny. So the middle tiers, it was kind of all over.
Yeah, I had Kevin is the only other, like, were there three people at the judges table on the top, it would have been obviously Danny and Rossica, and Kevin is a third. And I had it as you had it, which is like maybe Laura kind of gets in at a distant fourth because it was very sweet, but I think everybody genuinely appreciated it. Yeah, I mean, it was the first real miss for Michelle. I mean, you want to do Charlie? Let's do Charlie and Michelle, because they actually had a really interesting situation, which is that ISI whip, which is that great machine. And I actually have gotten one, and it's one of those great gifts I've gotten I'm afraid to use, and I need to at some point decide. You know, like, I'll get into foams, and I'll get into these little mousses, right? Like, I want to do it. It's like, you start introducing cartridges, and I might, like, blow up the house by accident kind of thing. Like, mm-hmm. I get a little nervous, but I have an ISI whip, and it malfunctions. So poor Charlie is sitting there. He's got this egg mousse. And in the last 40 seconds, he's spooning this stuff into the eggshell. Poor guy.
Just throwing it.
And I actually did some research. Like, John John seems like a great dish. It's kind of like, almost like it's like a mushroom. It's a black mushroom rice that is very common in northern Haiti.
Give it to me.
Yeah. No, I think both you and I, like give me, it's like just, and he had some chicken skins in there and some pickled mushrooms, and it looked really, really good. Tom's knock, and I think it was an appropriate critique, was, hey, if you're doing the egg, this is a rice dish. It's not an egg dish. And he's right. Mm. But John John looks like a really cool dish. Michelle, meanwhile, just kind of, she kind of just, her biscuit, the texture was not appealing. Certainly not to Kristen, who said it was crumbly. It did look like the components were, I mean, it did look like a yummy plate of food. I got to tell you, like, I don't care how crumbly a biscuit is. If you put a biscuit with chicken liver mousse, a sous vide chicken and stewed apples, like, I'm finishing the plate.
I feel like, Kevin, did you feel like the Frank Lloyd Wright prompt? Did you feel it in these dishes? Because when they announced the chicken or the egg, I was like, how is that part of the Frank Lloyd Wright motif? And then I started thinking, like, did you feel, Kevin, besides the similar and different French Laundry masterpieces that really did feel architecturally like Frank Lloyd Wright, did you feel that element in these dishes? Because I really didn't feel it with chicken or the egg. It just seemed okay.
No, I mean, the only one, like, I think the compression and release could have been interesting. You can play off compression, right? Like, you see those, like, compressed watermelon or compressed whatever. But even then, I think a really talented technical chef could have some fun with plating the compression and release.
Yeah, you know, Buddha's already, the motor's going.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like, I think if you put this in the hands of Buddha, I think he just delivers just, in fact, what would be fascinating is to do a Kish dish and bring Buddha in to do this challenge. Like, I would love to see what he would come up. And actually, maybe we pose that to him if he's listening. We're going to pose this to him when we record later this week about, hey, tell me what you do with this challenge, because he now is versed in basics in Frank Lloyd Wright 101. And he obviously is as a conceptual chef and as a technical chef, brilliant. Like, I thought the compression release could have been interesting. I mean, dark and light was sort of like, okay, let's do a contrast. Like, and it's not that Wright doesn't play with light in his stuff and in his work. It's just not where I think, like, it's not, he doesn't do it to the extent that, like, some of the Schindler and the mid-century guys do. Like, I don't know. It didn't, I'm with you. Like, I think they were all stretched. It was very funny. Savannah and Laura were, I want to do them for a second, because it was sort of, they were, as you said, Matt, right? Like, ribeye, maitake, tempura, which I think both you and I would devour.
Oh, yeah.
Give me maitake mushrooms in any form and give them in tempura form. And I'm there. She had grated daikon, a wild pistachio sauce. The dish needed acid, according to Kristen. Laura did the phyllo pistachio, potassio foam, and raspberry sauce. You sense a dessert she's done a million times and probably done really, really well. It was one of those instances, to your point about the Frank Lloyd Wright stuff, where I think this happens on Top Chef with narrative challenges where the story is a little strained. You know, Chris, it was one of my favorite moments of the show where Kristen's sort of coming into herself as a judge and with confidence. She's like, yeah, it went over my head. And she kind of rolled her eyes. Like, basically, it was her way of saying, like, look, the story didn't hold. I understand they had to, it was compulsory, whatever. And they weren't going to go home for it either, right? Like, the cook was good enough. They nailed the protein. They achieved the desired result.
I would have loved eating this. Like, those two dishes, I would have loved it.
Yeah, exactly.
It would have been delicious, and I would have been such a happy camper.
They got the desired texture on the tempura. The dessert was a little too sweet, but the components were well chosen and well assembled. The flavors complemented each other. Sort of the nuttiness of the pistachio, which goes great with raspberry. Basically, as you like to say, like like Savannah and Laura outran those who did not outrun the bear.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But there was nothing exceptional. I kind of felt the same way about Charlie and Michelle. Right. Like they outran those who did not outrun the bear. Dan and Amanda, again, like two really good just idea chefs. And you know, watching Dan with Elite Cannoli. And I love the teamwork there. Right. Like Amanda kind of saved him. Right. I mean, he's never worked with liquid nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
The mousse isn't setting for the cannoli. Or the potato mousse isn't setting. She gets that nitrogen to freeze the tray so that he can kind of then, you know, rescue himself. He does this leek cannoli potato mousse brown butter. It is a very simple dish to speak to the humility of the initiative that was Burnham Block. Let's find affordable housing to compete with like the Sears Roebuck Company in the early 20th century. It was a very noble pursuit for an affordable housing. Let's get some simple ingredients. It seemed like it did okay. Apparently the leek just wasn't cooked enough. And it's true, like leek's one of those things where if you nail it, it's great. If not, it's kind of mealy, right? You know? And then Amanda, like, again, good concept. Execution was less than the concept, maybe. Angel hair pasta, it looked delicious. I mean, you and I will eat a roasted scallop angel hair pasta caviar with a kombu oil and a seafood broth any day of the week.
And Kristen was like, why? We don't need to deconstruct this. You right. Overthought it a little bit. And you know what? I'm with Kristen on there. Again, another good critique where I thought the same thing, where I was like, you didn't need to do it that way. And I did appreciate the poverty and wealth narrative. They hit it. I think Dan would have saved himself if he just packed a little bit more punch with the flavor. Like when you're dealing with these humble ingredients, you kind of have to bring over the top seasoning or something to get it there. And it wasn't there. And so I felt like if I'm going to, I don't know, I feel like they're above Charlie and Michelle. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And then of course with dark and light, Manny and Kevon.
Yeah. That's a tough one because there were one, as I think Buddha said, one failed and one succeeded, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Surprising. Manny was the number one pick. And I got to say, I don't know if he's top four right now.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and again, it's, you know, he's had a couple of, I mean, I gave him a pass last week, right? Because he just hated that. He got the crappiest ingredient, the cheese curds. He hated the challenge.
Which Sue Odd probably apparently loves, by the way. We'll get to that.
I felt for him. I mean, I basically, you know, came to his staunch defense last week saying, look, sometimes you just got to take your ball and go home. I don't mind. You get one pout a season if you're a chef. You get one pout a season. Here, he gave it his all. But I think, like, in terms of pasta making, that's just not his bag, right? I mean, maybe it's his bag. I don't know. But I did. We saw a little bit of his limitations. You know, he did that. I never know the names. You know what I'm bad at, Tom, is the shape that corresponds with some of the pastas. Like, I didn't know Fiore was that little honeycomb. Like, I didn't know that. So, but, you know, he made it. It wasn't very good. He tried with the sauce poulet. And, but Kevon really came back. And I think we saw this technical chef was very successful in a technical challenge. Warm praline chocolate mousse, those little triangles. Everybody loved it. Like, he was decidedly the third best plate out of the 12.
How about Kristen's, to go back to Manny, the texture was like tuna fish.
Oh God, that was devastating. Yeah. She is, you know what it is? It's like, she's so good with the analysis and it's like the very selective barb and like, but she worships the altar of balance and texture. I love her taste in what's important on the plate, you know, like she's just, and I love the way she's expressing it. She's, you know, it's funny, like she's going to continue to grow at the ceremonial parts of the job. And you can say like, she's kind of on script a little bit sometimes at the beginning when they, okay, chefs today, blah, 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 blah. But when she gets at a dinner table, there's nobody I'd rather listen to. Like she's right up there with like Richard Blaise for me, like in sort of all time great. I mean, Colicchio's in his own, like, I mean, he's, like, whatever, he's above Mount Rushmore. He's like, he is the God in the sky presiding over Mount Rushmore, whatever. But like, Kristen is right up there with Blaze for me in terms of just, and Simmons, obviously, like just in terms of, I want to eavesdrop. If I'm at a restaurant, I want to hear what they think of what they're eating. Like, I want to listen in.
She's got some great one-liners and brings it with authority. And she, I'm loving it. She continues to, not that she needed to grow on me, but, you know, there is not a moment in the last, you know, three episodes where I've noticed, it's not landing. The only exception to that, I would say, is when she had to dismiss the two chefs here at the end, where it was like, oh, the whole I've been in your shoes aspect of this, there is that element too that really took me by surprise that this would be very emotional for her. Understandably so, especially when you're staring at two women who are like sobbing in front of you. That can't go over well when you're essentially sending them home. And let's be honest. No one wants to see their biggest career foible be on national TV. That's kind of the gambit with Top Chef, but like there is something kind of devastating about that, that Kristen clearly strikes a chord with her and she could barely get it out. Kevin could barely get it out.
I think about that all the time with this show when it doesn't go well. I don't mean one of these noble eliminations where, hey, it was just not your day, but where you feel like, you know, in this case, the chefs really, they struggled. They were at each other. It wasn't just a tactical fail. It was a manifestation of just sort of a bad temperament for basically 6 hours, right? That's it. And as you say, it was your worst career foil. These are two talented chefs. These are two women who can cook. And I think about this a lot. Like, can you imagine if our worst day at the office in, 15 years of NBA journalism was on display on national television. Like it's one thing. I think it's one reason I could never do one of these shows. Like I just, even when you people were pushing me to do the amateur home cook one, I was like, no, like I just like I, there, there's no reward that is, that could compensate for
getting undressed on. Yeah.
Yeah. Just the sheer hell of just failing. And I really felt for them. And in fact, I think it was compounded by the fact that they both didn't do well. This wasn't a Jen Carroll where she got thrown under the bus by in a dual challenge, right? Like this was, they both turned out poor dishes. They both were kind of, at each other and it just was a bad day. And I think it compounded the empathy. Like it just like, it was two bad dishes, but like whatever.
Was there, in your opinion, something that could have been done to prevent what happened? Because it seemed like there was a moment where I think Alicia was like, the chef is coming out of me right now. And she felt like she needed to assert herself more and be kind of not dickish, but like get on Kalina a little bit. But Kalina clearly was also trying to not cede her turf a little. There didn't seem to be a lead. Not that there has to be a leader, but they just were not vibing. And man, you just felt that discomfort. And I enjoyed that element of it, of just like, man, this really does feel like tension, real tension here, that in past seasons of Top Chef recently, we haven't gotten a lot of it. And it really just nails on a chalkboard watching them. And I hate to say it, but it was entertaining to see.
Well, it was very human, right? And I think of the two of them, Alicia was more self-aware of the dynamic in real time, right?
Yes.
I think, and that doesn't just come from the testimonials, right? Like there was this moment where she kind of very quietly clenched her teeth and said, I don't know why I would want to go back there right now, right? Like she was in the middle of executing, I think an important stage of her dish. She was, I think, of the two of them, more aware of the dynamic as it was unfolding. I think she was the more poised of the two. It just, the poise couldn't compensate for, I think, Kalina's anxiety as things really started to go bad. And I think I have to imagine if you're a chef and you take that crust out and it is in that state, like she ain't dumb. Like this is a professional chef. She knows what's going on, right? And that's where like my empathy for her is like, what is she going to do? Like there is nothing to do. And whereas I also felt for Alicia, because like I'm a punctilious anal person, and like the precision is the point of the whole thing, and the cuts weren't very good, but it's also, how do you even do the cuts when the crust is that hard? Like I can't imagine that was intentional. It was like, yeah, I'm trying to cut into stone here, right? And so, but Alicia was more attuned to the dumpster fire as it was starting to rage.
Yes. And I felt for her. She's not on my team. Kalina was a high pick for me, but I really felt for Alicia and Kalina. Kalina's been on these shows before, not Top Chef, but she's been on these shows before and she's won every time. So the fact that she knew she was probably getting sent home, and that internal monologue where she's hearing it as she's cutting into this, like, this sucks. I can't get it. The cut is bad. And she's telling me my cut is bad. And I know it's bad, right, but I don't want to acknowledge it because I'm trying to power through here. And then they got over their ego. And then they finally, like before it was too late, you know, they came to grips with it and they were like, all right, look, we need to come together here and get this out the door. And then they kind of smoothed things over and they got out there. But once the bell rung and it was Danny and Rosica, they knew they were going home. And I, look, they're going to Last Chance Kitchen. I was wrong. There isn't going to be like a quick turnaround for a re-entry here. Kevin, you are still your team. Kevin, the Chef's Table Club is still up in the standings. It's 54 to 37. It was not a good week for me. And I will point out this for you and the Chef's Table. I gave Rosica the win here. She was the winning chef. She got immunity for the next round. I gave the 5 points to Danny, and then Rosica gets the 10. You thought that that was fair?
Yeah, I think that's very fair. Absolutely. You know, she did get the win. I mean, she got the immunity. He didn't. I mean, it was very clear that she was the decided number one and he was on the top. No, I think you scored that absolutely correctly.
Okay. Cause I originally had it as 10-10, but, it just, she won, she got the immunity.
It's a weird week.
Chance Kitchen, Kevin.
Yeah.
Limburger. I have not been in the same room with a Limburger. I think I would know it if I was in the same room with a Limburger cheese. It is one of the world's stinkiest cheeses. And as soon as Tom gleefully pulled the hat off of the rabbit, he was just like, Kenny across the room was like, what the hell is that? Like, I can smell it from over here. And it is a Wash Rhine cheese. Kevin, Wash Rhine cheese. I like a good stinky cheese. I can't say that I would enjoy this one.
I got to admit, I can't recall having Limburger. I mean, you get those really, I mean, those nice washed cheeses with the kind of wrinkly rind that with a soft, like, I do like those. I don't know that I've ever had, though.
No.
I keep calling it Limburger, like Gary Cole in Office Space, my favorite movie. It's like my favorite movie. I love that movie so much. Yeah. But it was like, appropriately named. But I think we have to come to terms with the fact that the mystery number 16, Sue has some serious game, Tom.
I want him on the show so badly.
Yeah.
He's great. He is awesome.
Yeah.
He's assertive. He's confident. He's funny. He's good. When he mentioned that cheese curds were his favorite food, I was like,
I don't believe him.
This guy,
don't believe him.
This guy is so surprising. I don't believe him for a second,
don't
but
believe him.
He said it, you know, like, this is my fucking favorite food. Yeah. Cheese curds. And Kenny's like, what? Really? I feel like I should have it as my favorite food. Not you, Suan. And then he did this eggplant Parmesan where he took a blowtorch to the top that Valentine was like, what? You got a blowtorch, motherfucker? And he's like, yeah, I'm blowtorching this thing. And he crushed it. And you knew as soon as he gave it over to Tom that he was going to love that. He did the roasted tomato pomodoro with the ponzu sauce. And Kevin, I wanted to eat that off the screen. It looks so good. Even with the Limburger cheese, I was like, but then that... Shit, it looked good.
I'm curious, like ponzu sauce. I did not have ponzu sauce as an ingredient in our little eggplant parm with Limburger there. I got to tell you, I'm kind of fascinated. Like, I don't even know how that was utilized. I need to know more about this ponzu sauce in a parm, because I do make parm here. I have a partner whose favorite comfort food dish is parm. And we do the healthy version. I got to admit it. Like, we do the baked, fried. So I don't fry the cutlet breaded in the pan. Some people fry and then bake, or bake and then fry. I just bake with the little panko thing. So I do a slightly healthier version, which I still think. And I think my feeling is, okay, it's a vehicle for sauce and cheese and maybe breading. So, okay. Who's for the worst of it? But like, I do acknowledge that I probably need to do a full on, like, just put it in the friggin' pan with some oil, Kevin. Because I don't think mine is as good as like your good, whatever the place you grew up in the Northeastern United States where, like, you grew up in the Parmesan belt, Tom.
The Parm belt.
Maybe not Westport itself. North of Westport. North. You grew up just below the Parmesan belt. But you probably were treated to much better Parm than I was growing up in 80s Atlanta.
All right. So Kenny, I think, redeemed himself quite a bit with this episode here in Last Chance Kitchen with a grilled rice paper cheese pizza with a Vietnamese style. Ban Chung Un, I think it was. I probably butchered that, but with a melon, and the egg did not set, which sent him home. But I kind of felt like that was a tough opponent there. Suan is just, I feel like he's on another level. And I am only more confident in my theory that he was going to be on the show. He was going to be on the show because he's just got the full package here. He is a machine. He's going to go against, so Kenny goes home for good. You know what? The chef's table group didn't get Kenny. Just it didn't work out for Kenny. And he goes home with Valentine, and there is going to be a peanut gallery in LCK. Su-on moves on to go face the Alicia and Kalina duo. So Tom reveals that there's three more to go for Su-on before he re-enters into the competition. So I guess, does that mean that he has to beat both Alicia and Kalina and then a third person in order to get in? Or is it like a cook-off round where two people are going to go home and then there's two more after that? I don't know. What did you read? What did you interpret?
It's a little early for me, so long as, because what I don't like is then they start over again, where someone comes back in and they do it again.
Mm.
Like, I kind of like it where you really got to fight it out for 8-9 weeks, where it becomes this war of attrition and like someone gets on a roll. Like, I'm kind of, because what you're saying, three more, so they'll be coming in like after we're at 7 and then they come back in as the 8th, basically, is what we're talking about, right?
Yes, I think that's what it's going to be for Restaurant Wars. It's going to be 8 for Restaurant Wars.
Right. I mean, look, I guess it doesn't matter when you come back. But what I don't like is now you're, because also, I think it's also patently unfair that, oh, so you get an extra life if you get eliminated early from the competition, but if you last all the way to like the final 6, you don't get an extra life. Like, see, that's the part, that's sort of the fairness rule of play thing that I don't like, is like, if the understanding is LCK gives everybody a second life, other than up until like the final 4, I get that, then you shouldn't get, oh, you get rewarded for getting bounced early. Too bad you didn't get bounced. You lasted to the final 7. Now you're screwed. Like, I think that's, I'd like to see it enter in the final 5. Like, that to me is like that would be, and you got to go, hey man, you just got to run the table 10 times. That's, hey, those are the breaks. You got eliminated early, but you can do it.
I thought this was a great episode. I was really excited to tape today. So we've got Buddha coming up again. Packyourknives.com. Go subscribe, become a paid subscriber, and listen to our breakdown with Buddha Low. And also, we're going to be doing a chat next week's episode, a live chat for the East Coast showing. So we're going to do the 9 p.m. Eastern. Kevin and I will be there in the Substack chat. We're also going to open that up for free subscribers. So if you are a listener right now that you listen on Apple or Spotify, go to packyourknives.com, sign up. You can be a free subscriber and participate in our live chat next week. And of course, paid subscribers, you're already going to get that. And you're going to get Buddha Low. And you're going to go listen to Joe Flam. And if you haven't listened yet, Carly Levis was delightful last week.
Great.
It was awesome. And soon I got a little sneak peek at Kevin's video where he does an homage to Kristen Kish and a surprise ending, which I will leave for the suspense for watching it when it comes out. Your cook, how do you feel about it, Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little weird to be on camera cooking. My knife skills need work is, I think, my general takeaway. My knife skills need some serious work, but we're doing okay. And we're gonna play around with some like Top Chef theme, little minute and a half, 2 minute kind of fun little social media shareability videos. This is a new thing for me, so I'm just kind of I'm just playing around with some new toys. But Tom, closing thoughts on what I agree was a fun episode. Closing thoughts.
I didn't realize how good Kristen is at this show, but she's really good. Really good. And usually this stuff takes a while, might take a season. I thought the little choke up at the end was a little endearing.
Yep.
I thought it was really cool. Different dynamic that you're not going to get. Gail might have that some from time to time, get choked up with a chef story or sending someone home. You're certainly not getting it with Tom. And you're getting it with Kristen, and I kind of liked it. I kind of thought it was good. So, yeah, Rosica, beast mode.
Yes, that is, to me, the big takeaway is Rosica has emerged. She is Jackrabbit start, one of the great starts to open a season. For Tom Haverstroh, for producer Anthony Mays, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.